Chapter 22. On its reaction drives, the Scarabus flew through the empty space out with the war cage, thereby avoiding the omnipresent auto-defences, which, according to Toolbearer Hetchek, resided in hyperspace and could be projected with impunity against any intruder. Sam was sure that Resnik could have confirmed or denied such a bizarre claim, but still there had been no contact, no message from the construct drone. Sam was on the bridge, sitting at the command console, idly paging through an epedia about fourth modern L trade agreements while keeping an eye on the update subscreen. Gabrosan Mav was slumped in one of the workstation couches, while the hooded display before him showed the ship's course and speed against a graphic of the Warcage megasystem. He had been there since they had departed Armag, a sombre presence, scarcely uttering so much as a single word for the best part of 6 hours. Toolbearer Hetchek, unable to obtain more than a few monosyllabic replies for the last 2 hours, had retreated to engineering, from where he occasionally queried Sam on Gabrosan Mav's demeanour. She had been tempted to go and join him, but a certain stubbornness kept her at her workstation, monitoring chainer reports just in case anything surfaced that might tell her where the construct was. The Scarabus was on a curved trajectory towards Nagolka, a planet roughly halfway round the Warcage world array, with roughly 8 hours of flight time still to go. Armag was now nearly 3 hours behind them, and those visions of fiery destruction were still fresh in Sam's mind. The escape from that inferno, and the warship that unleashed it, had turned into a nerve-wracking getaway under fire when that same vessel began launching salvos of missiles at them. But the Scarabus's AI had put on a display of white-knuckled dodges and feints and split-microsecond timing, even as it powered its way up and out of the atmosphere. Of course, then there was another Shuskar warship up there in orbit to be evaded. A staggered pattern of mini-munitions with emitter payloads created an anti-sensor veil behind which the Scarabus made a brief dive back into the planet's upper atmosphere. Once they were in the clear on the other side of the planet, the ship AI opened up the main thrusters and they made a dash for open space beyond the Warcage. At which point, Toolbearer Hetchek had begun scanning for news from military and civilian sources while trying to make contact with various chainer bases and carders. Pieces of information filtered through, and a picture began to come together. A vile, horrific picture. When Hetchek sat Gabrosan Mav down on the bridge and gave him a summary of the situation, the chainer leader had gone pale and drawn. He leaned an elbow on the couch armrest and slowly pushed his fingers up through that dense, dark hair.
"Hoiken," Mav said. "What happened there?"
"Poison gas," said Hetchek. "Kregrin bombers dropped a mix of impact shells, mines, and hunter-killer probes. They targeted all 5 cities. Survival percentages are in low single figures."
"Ventia?" "The 3 cities in rebel hands were bombarded with contagion agents. Sedalkan units have ringed them with quarantine fields."
"Jerome?"
"Same as Armag City. Carpet bombed with skyfire munitions by the Inich. All 7 cities badly hit."
Gabrosan Mav went to ask about another 2 worlds, Dumaj and Divanda, and the Toolbearer's answers were uniformly grim. They and the rest were all planets where chainers had seized control, were openly supported by the authorities, or had bases and well-stocked caches. Responsibility for the attacks had been assigned to the Loyals, the top 7 battle armies of the Grand Escalade, who were always keen to prove their loyalty to their Shuskar masters. Dumaj and Divanda had been punished by the Lorzavel and the Murunzir respectively. It was now a certainty that it was the Avang who had firebombed Armag City and its environs. When Hetchek finished, Gabrosan Mav sat in silence for some moments.
So, now we know,
he said eventually.
All our planning, all our effort and sacrifice, all our endeavors seem to have been useless.
My leader,
the toolbearer began, but Mav cut him off.
This is it, the final, irrefutable proof.
The Chainer leader was angry and grief-stricken.
Proof that any rebellion against the Shuskar will fail. We made the mistake of thinking that the backing of the oppressed was all that was needed, and if we were fighting an enemy that was vaguely our equal, it might be enough. But the vile Shuskar control the meshes that bind our lives together, as well as a monopoly on the war cage's vast repositories of military might. Face them on any battlefield, and by sheer weight of brute force, they will always triumph.
His brow was furrowed as if in pain, and he shook his head.
We foolishly believed that we could hide away among the populations of those worlds, drawing strength from them, secretly building and training, that we and they would be safe from extreme retaliation. We never imagined, even Tloskin Rey never really thought, that they would countenance annihilating civilian populations simply to get at us.
He paused, glanced over at the toolbearer.
Do you have an estimate on the death toll yet?
Hetchek was grim.
Somewhere between 8.5 and 12 million.
Gabrozen Mav had a haunted, hollow look.
My old fight trainer once told me that every opponent you meet in the breach teaches you something. If I had learned this lesson well before now, millions might still be alive.
Studying him, Sam felt some sympathy, but she was still stuck here in this psychotic, self-contained carnival of tyranny, and since the construct drone was conspicuous by its absence, her options were limited and bleak. Was it possible to continue with the mission's original aim on her own? Or perhaps she was seeing the problem from the wrong angle. If she had greater freedom of movement and resources to draw on, then she could carry out a focused search for Rensic. Gaining control of the Scarabus was the obvious solution, but she doubted that Gabrozen Mav would be happy to just hand the ship over to her. However, rescuing the construct drone was vital, so it was time for a game changer. Is that it? She said. So, the Shuskar bear their teeth and deploy overkill methods just to demonstrate how mercilessly psychopathic they are? But you knew that already. I'm only a newcomer to the War Cage, yet it is utterly clear to me that the Shuskar have to be fought with unflinching resolve, fought on various battlefields and in various ways. There can be no negotiation or compromise with enemies like these, no middle ground, no halfway house. Because they won't be satisfied with just half your soul. They want it all. She sighed. You have to know this. Yet here you are saying that it's over. Gabrozen Mav looked up, angry eyes regarding her.
I never said that it was over.
Sam sat back, trying to look amiably composed. That's good to hear. Do you have a plan? The Chainer leader's grim features were unchanged when he looked over at Toolbearer Hetchek.
Gather together a ground force from any of the surviving Chainer bases, steal a heavy assault ship from one of the fleet worlds, then carry out a sneak attack on the Shuskar Citadel world, destroy as much of their machinery as possible, and get as much information out of any prisoners before we have to leave.
Hetchek nodded thoughtfully.
I remember this plan, my leader. You discarded it because the likely Shuskar counterattack would make an escape from the Citadel world almost impossible. Their effective fleet strength is already almost at full stretch,
Mav said.
They just do not have the trained crews to deploy more vessels, which greatly hinders their strategic advantage.
Toolbearer Hetchek nodded, his hooded features looking alert and focused.
Also, arranging diversionary strikes against one or two high-profile Shuska installations could make them think that these targets are the sum and total of our counterstroke.
Excellent suggestion. Which installations would be suitable?
The power cell factory on Khorosh and the Mount Yalk supply silo on Pomelik. Both are crucial to Shuska supply lines and are located in the vicinity of portal gates. That makes them easier for our portal snaggers and easier for the strike forces to make a swift withdrawal.
How quickly can Chainer Groups mount such operations?
Gabrosin Mav said.
From orders to forward rally point, between 10 and 12 hours.
Mav nodded.
Good. In the meantime, we'll need a contingent of troops for when we reach the Shuska Citadel world.
We have a Chainer Cadre on Malgin Cog,
Hetchek said.
They have been training recruits from the clan towns for more than 3 string months. The Malginori are a Muranzia offshoot and are quite a belligerent lot.
They sound ideal,
said Mav.
We'll head there, get them boarded, then fly to the Fleet World Nagolga.
Nagolga, said the toolbearer. But would not Shankol be closer?
True, but Shankol has 2 garrisons and a full complement of combat flyers. The Nagolga multi-yards are far less tactically daunting.
If I might make an observation, Sam said, cutting in. First, it's a good plan, and I like it. And second, are you sure that you have the stages of the plan the right way round? Gabrosin Mav frowned.
Why delay the ability to strike?
Why make preparations before you know what you will be facing? Mav's glare softened to a glower, which was then directed at the toolbearer.
What do we actually know about the Nagolga Yard complex? Was there ever a mission profile?
Hetchek shook his head while glancing at his workstation display.
According to the archives I brought with us, there is only a survey summary, and it's over 40 years old.
You'll have to go to Nagolga first, Sam said. Send out messages to your secondary bases, set up the diversionary strikes, and get your ground troops ready for embarkation. But you need to scout out the enemy positions, what your mission goal is, and what it will take to reach it. Intelligence is key. Without it, you'll be going in blind. Gabrosin Mav met her gaze, and for a moment she thought he was going to refuse her suggestion, insist on following his plan. Then he looked at the toolbearer, who nodded.
Very well,
Mav said.
We scout the area first.
Encrypted commands were sent to a string of Chainer bases and contacts. A course for Nagolga was plotted, and everyone settled in for a long journey. Toolbearer Hetchek, while analysing packets of battle and recon reports received from the base network, tried to engage Gabrosin Mav in a discussion about possible unit deployments. But Mav's mood had turned morose for whatever reason, and eventually the toolbearer wandered off to engineering. Sam remained on the bridge, concerned that her departure might make it seem as if she and the toolbearer were colluding in avoiding Mav's company. Another chilly hour passed before she realized that she actually wasn't that concerned, so she rose and left, heading for the main hold. She could retask one of the terminals down there to keep track of chain reports, but that was not her primary reason for this sidetrack. It was less than a day since the ship AI told her about the sensor data being read from the cryostasis canister holding Oleg Kelitak's body. Now that the chaos of Armag was behind them, curiosity was nagging at her, demanding to be satisfied. Several minutes later, she was on the upper gantry of the main hold, following it round to the special storage room. Presence glows flickered on as she entered, the hatch clunking heavily shut behind her. Oleg's cryostasis canister was shelved at shoulder height halfway down the long narrow space, its monitor display showing black characters and symbols against pale green. She studied the sensor data, shifting the sections along by touch, studying timescale comparisons, then paused, frowning, hands resting on the canister surface. "Ship," she said, "are you there?"
"Yes, Lieutenant Brock, I am."
"These readouts, is this right? The vital signs restarted? Heart and respiration continued for nearly half an hour, then just stopped?"
"The data is correct, Lieutenant. However, core temperature is now lower than it was before this activity, and sensors are detecting compounds associated with post-death cell degeneration. There are also the first indications of muscle stiffness."
Sam shook her head sadly. "So, he wasn't in any kind of Kiskashian pseudo-hibernation then?"
"No." "Speculation? Some variants of the Kiskashian genome may have evolved post-trauma survival states, which we were unable to treat and accommodate correctly due to absence of knowledge."
"If that was so, why wouldn't Mojag's copy of Oleg have passed on such knowledge to Pike or someone?" She shrugged. "Well, it's academic now." She left the storage unit, descended to the main hold floor and the recessed room with its hold controls and secondary workstations. But after nearly an hour, she grew restive, recalling how comfortable that couch was up on the bridge, which was also maintained at a cozier temperature than the hold. Eventually she gave in, transferred her ongoing screen state back to the bridge, and left the hold. Gabros and Mav glanced up for a moment when she re-entered the bridge, sparing her only a cold and dark look before going back to the display of weaponry stats which filled his screen. As she settled back into the workstation couch, Sam observed the chainer leader out of the corner of her eye.
"There's no way you'll be taking me out on a recon," she thought. "All that matters is how many you leave behind to guard the ship. For personal safety, you'll take Hetchek and two guards, leaving two aboard and two I can handle. You'll feel betrayed when you see the Scarabus lift off and depart, certainly no less than this Pike was when you stole his ship in the first place. And I shall undoubtedly feel guilt and remorse for my own part, too. But once I've tracked down the drone, we can and will complete the mission."
Spidery, leafless trees and bushes lined the deep, fog-bound ravine along which Akreen trudged. True, it was a fabricated place, left behind in the deepest recess of his mind, but it still felt as if he had been trudging along it for a weary eternity. Gredaz was leading the way, his tall, broad-shouldered form made pale by the thick, swirling fog. Not for the first time, Akreen reflected upon these surroundings with a certain scorn, knowing this stark vacancy to be the only context setting that his etiolated precursors had been capable of fashioning, a harsh, confining chasm. How galling it was to be ambushed by his ancestors and then thrust down into this place. Clearly, they had been planning and preparing for such an eventuality, and when Khor had attacked him, his resulting incapacity was all the opportunity that they needed. Not that they were receiving treatment any less severe than if Akreen were still fully in control. With Rajeg as spokesman, they had tried to assure Khor of their loyalty by spilling all they knew about Gredaz and the plan for Akreen to travel to Katuzna to meet a Zavri ancestor, a survivor from before the Great Unshackling War against the Apparatarch. Having convinced Khor that they really were collectively Akreen's precursors and that Akreen's self was imprisoned within, they were now leading him down into an ancient underground complex in search of the ancestor, drawn there by those faint flickers of bioelectric resonance that all Zavri emanate. From the shifting brightness far above, Akreen could just hear his precursors, their bursts of compulsive squabbling interspersed with irascible comments from Rajek. The expedition with Khor had thus far not brought them anywhere near their goal. Not long ago they had reached a T-junction, followed the meagre bioelectric trace along to one side, only to find the corridor ending abruptly at the brink of an immense deep fissure that rose to open sky. And when they went back to try the other side of the junction, they narrowly escaped being crushed by a corridor collapse, barely making it through. Now, Rajeg and Khor were heading along and up since Khor claimed that he had spotted a crude bridge spanning the gulf about half a kilometre away. So while they were negotiating a route through centuries-old, ruined passageways, Akreen was doggedly plodding along after Gredaz. On their arrival down here, Gredaz had insisted that a pseudo-subjective context like this could be altered by focused and unflinching purpose, which turned out to be true. The rocky ravine appearance and the leafless trees weren't much, but were a definite improvement on the empty blank pit they were tossed into. Occasionally he was sure he heard whispers from beyond the fog, muffled footfalls, and once a brief hoarse laugh. Gredaz insisted that these were merely after-echoes from his precursor's presence, part of the persistent quality of Zavri memory. Akreen pondered this, unsure if it was in the long term an advantage or a disadvantage. Suddenly Gredaz halted, stretched out his left hand, took a pace to the left, then another, which was almost enough to be swallowed utterly by the fog. Then he re-emerged to beckon Akreen, and there, in a cleft in the rough black rock, was a rack of crude narrow steps leading up.
"Our ascent begins," Gredaz said with a bleak smile.